time of year, so we'll get going, and we have a lot to cover tonight. So first of all, welcome everyone. Really especially appreciate your presence with everything else that's going on. A lot of various, many kinds of holidays and celebrations that are going on right now. So thank you for being here. Pardon my phone. So I want to start by introducing our newest SAC member, and so please join me in welcoming Elma Blum. She's the City of Vancouver representative, and Elma, would you please share a little bit about yourself so we can get to know you?
Hi, so I'm Elma. I'm a software engineer. I work at a company called ForgeRock. It's in Vancouver over by Cascade Park. Let's see. I'm not obviously in healthcare, but I'm very interested in public health, and I feel like I really like listening to data. It's kind of boring, but I want to see if I can help translate that into maybe public health palatable communication. So that's kind of where I think I would have a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds excellent. Well, thank you for joining our council. We're very happy to have you. The next thing that's going to happen, we do have a guest, and I'll get to that in a minute, but I'm going to do a roll call. And as you, as I call your name, would you please say, what is your role on FAC? Are you representing an organization, or tell just a little bit about your role on the FAC group? So I'm going to go down the list that I think is still the most recent. Hopefully I have everyone on here, but if I don't, speak up if I don't call your name. So I know that Michelle Stickley is the first one on the list, and she is not able to attend this evening, but she serves as a consumer of public health services. And the next is Sandy Brown.
Hi, I'm Sandy Brown, and I represent Consumer of Public Services, and I'm a member at large on the executive board this year.
Thank you. And next will be you, Elma, and we just got to hear from you, so thank you for being here. Next is Paul Childers.
Paul is unable to attend today.
Oh, okay. I think you told me that. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. All right. Next, we have Mark Collier.
Hello. I represent septic installers, maintenance people, and septic designers.
Right. Thank you. And then next, we have Remy Eason.
I'm Remy Eason. I represent the Dental Society here in Clark County.
Thank you, Remy. And Adrienne Fairbanks.
Hi there. I'm at work. So I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I represent veterinarians in Clark County.
Great, thank you. Dave Fuller is also not able to be here this evening. Next is Peggy Carlson.
Good evening, everyone. I'm representing the educational community.
Thank you. Andy Santos.
Hello, my name is Andy Santos, and I am the student representative.
Thanks for being here, Andy. Shona Carter.
Hi, my name is Shona Carter, and I'm with the Community Foundation for Southwest Washington. I'm their VP of Community Engagement and Strategy.
Thank you. And the next person would be Dr. Lawrence Neville, but he has left Peace Health, so he will no longer be on our council. He was a representative for Peace Health, so we'll be seeking another person to take that position. And next is John Brooks. Not seeing John at this point. Stephanie Bryce Yamashita. Stephanie yet. And then Tyler Clary.
I'm Tyler Clary, and I am the Clark County Water Utility Representative.
Thank you for being here. And I'm Marla Sanger, a consumer of Public Health Services. And next is Maria Swinger-Inskeep. Maria, not seeing her. Cassandra Sellers Rep.
Marla, I don't see Cassandra, but I do see Maria. Maybe she was having difficulty unmuting.
Okay, I see her now. Thank you. Good. And then Aru Hendrick, Dr. Aru.
Hi, I'm Aru, I'm Dorothy Hendrick, and I'm representing physicians in Clark County.
Thank you for being here. And then Dr. Melnick, who's an ex officio member.
Hi, I'm calling in on my phone, or using my phone. I'm actually in Asheville, North Carolina, at a National Association of County and City Health Officials board meeting. But, you know, here it's after 8:30, so the board meeting is over, and I'm delighted to be here with all of you.
Well, thank you for making the effort. It's really working. We can see you and hear you, both crystal clear, so thank you.
Great.
And Heather Decker.
Yes, I'm Heather Decker, and I represent Legacy Salmon Creek Medical Center.
Great. And is there someone on the council, not counting guests, who I have not named? Okay, I think we're good. All right, thank you, everyone. So we have a pretty tight agenda, and so we're going to move right along, but we do have a guest today. If there are any other guests, after I introduce the one that I know about, please speak up and let us know. So this evening we have joining us Weston Perkins Clark. And would you please tell us a little about yourself, and then people can see who you are, and it's a great way to get acquainted.
Hi, my name is Weston Perkins Clark. I am here representing American Medical Response, the ambulance provider here in Clark County. I just took on a role as their senior community education coordinator, so I'm looking to get the EMS side of things a little bit more involved in the public health sphere, because I do have my background in public health. I have my master's in public health from North Dakota State University, in health sciences. Prior to this, I worked in conjunction with CMAR, Community Health Centers, and Peace Health Southwest as their multiple visit patient community health worker to try to connect dots in the outpatient setting as to why they were coming into the hospital. I actually worked under Dr. Neville two or three steps down. But I just took this role on recently, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, welcome. We're delighted to have you as a visitor, and hope that we'll have a chance to get to know you better. Great. Okay. So the next thing on the agenda is the review of our minutes from October 12th. And there was a lot going on in that meeting. And I hope that you all had a chance to look at the minutes. And I'm going to assume that this occurred. And I would ask someone to please bring forward a motion. And we'll vote to approve the minutes.
I make a motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, perfect. Did you get those, Doreen? Thank you very much. All right, then we'll move right on to the review of the agenda. So it's going to be a pretty interesting evening tonight. We do have, I think that Weston was the person that was going to provide comment. Is that right, Doreen, or is there someone else? Okay, good. All right, well, good. We got to hear from him. That was excellent. The rest of the agenda is going to involve, I'm going to let Dr. Melnick say more about this, but we're going to be speaking a little bit about Janice Koch tonight and giving her some very much due appreciation. So I'll let you take it from there, Dr. Melnick. We'll hear from Alyssa Payne, who will be presenting about environmental public health. Jeff Harbison is going to be presenting our budget update. Andrea Pruitt is going to be presenting on the racial equity training activities that are being planned and organized.
Dr. Melnick again will be presenting again on COVID-19, and there's a lot going on with that, as you all know. Then we're going to be taking a vote on our updated bylaws, which everyone has had a chance to look at from the last meeting until now. Then we'll talk about the slate of new officers, and we'll also be introducing, welcoming Brian Schlottman, who is going to be assuming the role that Janice had been fulfilling. So Dr. Melnick will take it from there on that. So let's go ahead and get started then. Dr. Melnick, if you could begin with that topic of Janice and Brian.
Thank you, Marla. And I'm kind of sad to announce that Janice Koch, who is our Environmental Public Health Director, who I think you've all come to know well, she's been with Clark County Public Health for 14 years. So, a number of years as Director of Environmental Public Health. And she brought a lot to the program. And actually, she helped hold everything together during the pandemic, which affected a lot of our services. She also had she's also really helpful to our organization in terms of her background in quality improvement and performance management. So, and she was a wonderful spokesperson for environmental public health. She's going to be, and a great member of our leadership team. So, we're going to miss Janice greatly. She's not here tonight. She wasn't able to be here. Otherwise, I would have put her on the spot. I'm pleased to announce that we found a great replacement. I mean, Janice is a hard act to follow, but Brian Schlottman was an internal candidate. We had a number of really strong candidates, both internally as well as externally, for the Environmental Public Health Director. Brian was one of our program managers he's been impressive as a program manager in environmental public health, but he really also impressed everybody with his application and performance for the environmental public health director position. I'm going to put Brian on the spot since I know he's here and let him talk a little bit about himself, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. I probably should have prepared for this. Thanks, Alan. Janice does have some huge shoes to fill, but I got to work under Janice for 2.5 years as a program manager. I presented to FAC a few times for some of the programs that I got to manage. So, yes, she will be missed, there's a little bit of overlap, so I'm trying to learn as much as I can in the last few days that we have together. I've been with public health since April of 2019. I got my master's from George Washington, master's in public health from George Washington University. Before that, I worked with the city of Hillsborough for about 16 years, working on folks with disabilities, getting more inclusive programs going, and working on a strategic plan for inclusion of people with disabilities. And also ran a nonprofit for a while that worked on teaching golf to kids with disabilities. So I come with a wide variety of experience and I'm really excited to work with this group.
If I could just add one thing, I really believe in the importance of succession planning, and I have really witnessed some very intentional, what I would say, movement of Brian through, his role under Janice into the role that he's now assuming, and that really pleases me because I while he's been doing that, he's been bringing in interns and helping them get started in their own career in public health. So anyway, I'm just so grateful that you're taking this role, Brian. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, Alyssa is here to present some of the work that one of our interns did, which we're very proud of. It's produced something to work. Excited to get out.
Excellent. That was great. Thank you. Okay, well, I think, Alyssa, you're up next.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. So my name is Alyssa Payne. I'm an environmental health specialist at Clark County Public Health. I'm going to quickly share a project we have been working on the last several years. So in 2019, we contacted 34 vet contacts representing approximately 40 clinics in our community to obtain email permissions to send advisory updates prior to 2020. In 2020, as an internship project done by Keelan Kelly, who is interested in pursuing a master's in veterinary science, she interviewed 15 of those 34 clinics to determine satisfactions in newsletter, incidents of habit exposure in pets and animals, and also inquired what resources or materials would be most useful to help educate those pet owners. And so those interviews, including staff member Adrian, stated the need for a brochure that could be given to new pet owners, commonly called new puppy packets. So in 2021, with the help of Lee Radford, our local graphic designer here in Clark County, took that draft brochure that Keelan created and created what you are hopefully going to be seeing on my screen. Awesome. So with the help of Keelan Kelly and the work that she did in her internship and with the graphic design of Lee Radford, we were able to create this two-page brochure. A couple of items I want to highlight in this brochure is the awesome content you find in the center of the brochure, where we have information on how to identify a harmful algal bloom, signs and symptoms if you do think your pet was exposed, and then how to keep your animal safe. And then we also wanted to be sure to include information on what to do if you think your pet was exposed, so rinsing under cold water immediately. Also providing phone numbers on how to get your questions answered if you can't immediately see your local vet, and then also information how they can report those illnesses directly to us. And so we are distributing this brochure and other materials provided for free by the CDC to educate veterinarians and pet owners on how to avoid algal blooms and identify suspected exposure. We're also sharing this brochure with the Southwest Washington Stormwater Partners and our Clark County Green Neighbors program, so it can be distributed at their outreach events as well. And so a huge thank you to Adrian Fairbanks for supporting this project and also assisting me and our intern, Keelan. And if you have any questions, please let me know. But yeah, we are hoping to get these widely available very, very soon.
That just looks terrific. I mean, it looks like you've really done a lot of homework and research, and it looks just wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love the look of the brochure.
Yeah, it looks really great. You guys did such a nice job, and I feel like, you know, it is such a horrible to be able to just have it all concise. And I think that I didn't even think about that idea of puppy pack. That's perfect, because one, I need to be with new owners with all sorts of information and wanting to take fees and going places. So that's a great way to put it. Another place to put that pamphlet too. So good job.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. I'm going to stop sharing my screen.
Well, thank you, Alyssa, for coming and sharing that information with us. And I know that this is kind of an area of many dog lovers, and I none of us wants to see a dog harmed, especially when we might have the ability to prevent that harm. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
And I believe, Jeff, you're up next for our 2022 budget update.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Hello, everyone on FAC. Jeff Harbison, I'm the Director of Administrative Services. Our 2022 budget was approved earlier this winter, late fall. Our environmental public health fee adjustments were approved with a 5-0 vote of the council, which was, I don't want to say surprising, but a little surprising. The Board of Health did land on a approach for our drinking water and our on-site septic permitting program at a 90% cost reimbursement through fees and 10% support from the general fund. All of our requested positions through both the American Rescue Plan Act, our foundational public health services funding, expansion of our federal STD prevention funding, everything was approved. So we are off and running in the 2022. I will say that the council did not approve the 1% property tax adjustment. So it's looking like there will be challenges moving forward for the general fund. If I had to anticipate, I would look at potential reduction directives for 2023. But as of right now, that is just speculation. So for right now, things are looking okay. If there are any questions on our budget or our environmental public health fees, I can field them now.
Why did they not approve the 1% increase?
The testimony and conversation between the councilors talked about the cost to the homeowners. That was the public testimony. That was the public conversation. It was a 3-2 vote.
So is there anything that that our FAC group can do to further the needs that you are describing that may not be met?
That's a great question. As in the past, what we'll do is we will definitely engage the Public Health Advisory Council as the 2023 budget process plays out. And actually, I believe, Dr. Melnick, with the new legislation, your role with the budget process has changed.
Correct. And so we actually are responsible for reviewing the budget planning and the budget itself. So we definitely want to be more involved than we've been able to be in the past. And I see Dr. Melnick agreeing.
Yes, I agree, and that was, you know, specifically mentioned in the legislation that passed House Bill 1152, that the, you know, FAC is now what's defined as a community health advisory board, and one of your roles is to provide input into the budget.
Correct.
We're definitely looking forward to that.
Yep, me too. Great. Okay, well, thank you for that. That was a great update. Appreciate it, Jeff. Andrea, you're going to bring us up to date on what's going on with the racial equity training update.
Yes. Good evening, FAC. For those of you I haven't met, my name is Andrea. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm our community health director. So since the last time this group convened, we have held a series of 3 meetings with our leadership team and our racial equity work group, 2 with leadership team and 1 internal racial equity work group meeting. We hosted a joint viewing of the first of the webinar series, the APHA series on advancing racial equity. And the first webinar is titled Racism, the Ultimate Underlying Condition. And so it's a 3-part webinar. We viewed it as a group, engaged in a dialogue after the session. And it was really, the dialogue was centered around what the experiential process was for the individuals observing the webinar and how and what it would look like for us to operationalize this series or educational 6-part series versus another option moving forward into 2022. We extended our discussion into a second meeting, and at that second meeting we really agreed that not only do we want to consider what the baseline understanding for our staff will be, I think we have a wide range of understanding and experience examining our identities and what it looks like operationalizing what racial equity looks like within the public health discipline. So some of our racial equity group members are also on our health assessment and evaluation team. So we agreed to a 2-step process. We're going to do a baseline assessment of our staff's understanding and level of comfortability discussing racial equity and experience doing work in that space across their priority areas. And we're going to use that information to match with what we believe to be are the strengths of this APHA webinar series to get a good idea if we can use the series kind of as is, or if we need to maybe break it apart into its subcomponents to really give folks time to consider and think critically and deeply about what they're learning. So that's survey one. And the second part about that that came out is in 2022, we really want to expand what the engagement on the racial equity workgroup looks like. And so because we don't have a great understanding of what the capacity and interest of our staff is, we'll send out another general survey because that will help us determine how best to structure engagement. If there's 40 people that want to be engaged, that would be fantastic. And making sure that we can have really meaningful group dialogues, structuring some of our work around affinity groups and really setting up spaces to move some of the work forward that was identified in the strategy map by the group before the pandemic. So a lot of those dialogues are happening and taking place. A lot of dialogues around distribution of power and ensuring that we have the right information in place in terms of folks that want to onboard to the committee, understanding what that space will look like, feel like, and be like with respect to the dialogues ongoing. So we have another meeting scheduled for January 13th, where we'll continue the discussions about the APHA webinar series. And hopefully by that point, we will have the survey language put together. We'll be able to administer that to teams, and then we'll be able to view what some of that feedback looks like. And hopefully we'll be able to share that with you in the next meeting.
Well, I'm thrilled that the amount of work that is going on at the front end is happening, because a lot of times I think a program is adopted or a certain strategy is adopted without the really thoughtful efforts that you guys are making in order to come up with something that is truly meaningful and is going to make a difference. I think probably many of us have seen things that have been really just kind of window dressing and have been involved in some trainings that have been truly meaningful and life-changing. So the work that you guys are doing right now is going to make a big difference for the folks that get the opportunity to be recipients of this training.
And the one thing I would add is for folks who may be newer to this space, we did apply for some funding to support this work. The funding request ultimately was rolled into a more generalizable scope of work that the county will be taking on relative to equity, diversity, inclusion, and inclusion work, which was less specific to racial equity work. So we really wanted to continue doing everything we could, bless the funding. There's a lot we can do. There's a lot of really amazing resources, and we're relying on many. So if you have a resource that you love, that's important to you, that you feel like could inform the work, that level of collaboration is always deeply appreciated. So a lot of our work group members have local resources they love, so we rely on GARE, APHA, really a wide depth and breadth of available resource that is not necessarily fee-based. So we'll continue to evaluate opportunities to fund the work long-term as well.
Great, thank you for that. Does anybody have questions for Andrea on that topic? It's something that we're learning about. Yes, Weston.
So one of the biggest projects that I have is coming in 2022 with AMR is addressing health inequities, specifically in the EMS realm. And I'm utilizing data that was gathered specifically about Vancouver with Healthcare Equity Group over in Portland. So any way I can help or any way you would like to help, please let me know either way, because I have a huge task before me. Especially because when the study came out in 2019, it was presented very rashly to EMS providers. So there is it's an uphill battle going forward with that.
Yes, I would would love to connect on so many levels, and I think there's an opportunity to really use the bridge that is EMS and AMR in between essentially two communities that are on opposite continuum of the journey of racial equity. That's not to kind of cast a net over all like our law enforcement partners, but I think in terms of where they are in that journey, the work that we have to do locally and regionally, we need as many opportunities as we can to have those dialogues. So yes.
Great connection made right there.
Exactly.
Okay. Anything else on this before we move on? Okay, then I'm going to turn it over again to Dr. Melnick with the COVID-19 update. And it seems like every day there's some big news, and maybe you'll help us kind of think about how do we get our arms around it and what do we want to be able to latch onto so we can share with our friends and neighbors and try to keep real, true science-based information out there in the community as best we can.
Any help you can all provide, that includes, I think you know how to make public comments before the Board of Health meetings as well. I think we've circulated that information, so that's always welcome. I don't have a formal presentation. I'm going to be brief here and give you all some updates. So just to remind folks, we became aware of the Omicron variant on November 26th when the World Health Organization classified it as a variant of concern, and the first U.S. case was detected December 1st in California. Since then, it's been detected in many states. My notes say 33. I think it's more than that now. We've had cases in Washington, Thurston, Pierce, and King counties, and I believe Oregon is now has the Omicron variant as well. I just checked the CDC site. I think there's some news coming out of there, but it's been found in Oregon as well. And as I said, we've had at least a few cases in Washington. I'm not aware of any cases in Clark County yet. Washington State has a fairly robust process for sequencing and looking for variants. There's a representative sampling that goes on, as well as if there's any unusual cases or high attack, outbreaks of high attack rates, those specimens get sent for sequencing. So we're continuing to look for it. We're still learning about Omicron. The data coming out of South Africa, since it took over so quickly, indicates that it might be that it's more transmissible, certainly than the original strain of the virus. But we don't know for sure exactly how it compares to transmissibility of the Delta variant, which we know is more significantly more transmissible than the original virus. We don't know whether it causes more severe disease in the other variants. So far, it's not looking like it does so. And also, the good news is the current, the evidence shows that current vaccines are expected with the Omicron variant, limited evidence we have that the vaccines help prevent severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths due to Omicron. But given the transmissibility world, we are likely to see breakthrough infections. Some preliminary evidence shows that people who have previously had COVID-19 could become more easily reinfected with Omicron, but again, data are limited. We don't know yet how effective COVID-19 treatments are against Omicron. There's a bit more mutations on the spike protein. It's possible. Again, we're learning more that things like monoclonal antibodies may not be as effective, but we don't know for sure. Some good news is that current COVID-19 tests, both the antigen as well as a PCR test, can detect infections with Omicron. They're not used to find Omicron specifically, but your test will be positive for COVID-19 if you have Omicron with those tests. Delta continues to be the dominant strain in the United States, accounting for 97% of cases. Omicron is now responsible for around 3%. So the other thing about Omicron is, you know, the steps we've been taking to avoid getting and spreading COVID-19 are the same things we need to do with Omicron. So I'm going to mention boosters in a moment here, but, you know, certainly get vaccinated and certainly get a booster dose if you're eligible, which is anybody. Basically, I believe now 16 and 17 year olds can get boosted as well. So, if you're eligible, get booster doses. You know, physical distancing, masking, staying home if you're sick, getting tested if you have symptoms, you've been around somebody with COVID-19. All those things are important in the time of Omicron as well. You know, vaccination, it continues, no matter what you hear elsewhere, including social media, continues to provide the best protection against COVID-19, especially against severe illness, but it protects against infection itself, severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. Most cases continue to be among those who are not fully vaccinated. And the thing we do know is that the boosters can increase the immune response. So, and especially now that that Omicron is around, more reason why people should be getting boosters, not that they didn't need a reason before. I've already mentioned that a youth 16 to 17 years of age can get boosters. Of course, to get the, and anybody 18 and older, so can get a booster dose. For youth 16 and 17, the booster would, the original vaccine would have to be Pfizer, and their booster would have to be Pfizer. But people who are 18 and older, if you've had previous vaccination, you can mix and match. Booster can be any one of the vaccines. You're eligible if you've had either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine. You're eligible for booster 6 months after your second dose. With the J&J vaccine, you're eligible for a booster 2 months after the last dose. And like I said, you can mix and match. The vaccines are widely available, but given the demand for the boosters and probably related to concerns about Omicron, the appointments may be somewhat, may take a bit more time to get. And we would recommend that you be you continue calling or, you know, reaching out to get the vaccine, and be patient, that you should be able at some point to get it, because it's pretty there's a substantial supply of vaccine in the community. I think the appointments are just filling up pretty quickly, and also, you know, appointments are filling up because children, you know, 5 to 11 can get vaccinated now. People who have questions about whether they should get the booster, talk to your healthcare provider. I just wanted to mention COVID vaccine, 19 vaccine for children. Again, it's the Pfizer vaccine. That's the only vaccine available for people under 18, and it's now available for children 5 to 17. And on November 2nd, it was recommended, before November 2nd, it was 12 and older. Now 5 to 11-year-olds can get it. Just like adults, the Pfizer vaccine for kids is two doses that are administered 3 weeks apart. But the dose, the childhood dose, the 5 to 11 dose, is one-third of the adult, the adolescent and adult dose. You should call your, people should call their child's primary care provider for a vaccine appointment. And it may be available also at some local pharmacies, but you need to call the pharmacy in advance. The vaccine may be available for children 6 months to 5 years, or, you know, 6 months to, and older during this winter, but I'm not sure exactly when. I want to mention a couple of things. I want to talk about vaccines briefly. The vaccine rates in Clark County continue to increase, unfortunately, slowly. Right now, 67% of residents that are 12 years of age and older are fully vaccinated. That leaves a third of people who are 12 and older unvaccinated, or not fully vaccinated. That's a concern.
statewide, we're at 67%. Statewide, 73% of residents 12 years of age and older are fully vaccinated. In Clark County, 81,000 people have received boosters, and around the state, 1.3 million people have received boosters. We don't have data on 5 to 11-year-olds in Clark County yet, but around the state, 159,000 children 5 to 11 years of age have received one dose. That is about 23%, and 91,000 children, about 13.5% children 5 to 11 statewide are now fully vaccinated. One last thing I want to mention is that we've been doing mobile vaccine teams to administer boosters for individuals that are having difficulty accessing vaccinations elsewhere. These include residents of adult family homes and long-term care facilities, people are homebound and people are unhoused. Last month, we began sending mobile vaccination teams to adult family homes to administer boosters, and for those at adult and family homes who had not received the first and second doses, we were doing that as well. And in 1 month, our teams use volunteers, 343 volunteer hours with the Medical Reserve Corps. We visited 137 adult family homes and administered 650 doses of the vaccine, of which 623 were boosters. So we're going to continue to work on that. That's my update, and I'm happy to answer questions that folks have. If you're all still awake after listening to me.
So what questions do we have out here?
Got a couple of hands raised there.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go send my hand raised. I'm kind of curious, Dr. Melnick, with the, with Pfizer and Moderna, as you get to that 6-month time frame, I mean, they're talking that the efficacy of the vaccine, it just goes down beyond that point. And then with that in mind, are they talking at some point about changing, I guess, what the definition of fully vaccinated is potentially? I mean, unless you're boosted, or is that, is there talk of that, or is that...
That is a really excellent question. So the reason for the boosters is that, the protection tends to wane over time. And now that you've asked the question, I wanted to point out that there's a lot of stuff going on social media about so-called natural infection. I like to term it infection caused, protection or immunity versus natural. But there's good evidence now that the vaccine-induced immunity is less than you'd get through a natural, infection. But the protection does wane over time, and that's the reason for the booster. There's been a couple of studies, from the CDC showing that vaccination is more effective than previous infection. The other thing I want to point out is that the whole purpose of vaccines is to keep you from getting sick and hospitalized and dying in the first place. So going for an actual infection to get some immunity is not a really good strategy, especially since you can't predict whether you'll, get hospitalized, die, or end up with something like long COVID. So the point of vaccines is to not get sick in the first place. So I'm giving you more than what you asked for in an answer, but the bottom line is that immunity, even with the vaccine, concern that it could diminish over time, and that's where we're at with the booster. In terms of whether the definition of fully vaccinated, right now at this point, I've heard of no plans to change the definition of fully vaccinated to include booster. That could happen over time. That's happened with other vaccines in the past. I mean, we've got a number of other vaccines that require more than one dose. But there's no plan to do that. You do get a very robust increased immunity with that booster dose. So I want to add that as well. So that's a really long-winded answer to your question. But I hope I answered it okay.
Yeah, can I just, so you, did you say that natural infection is a stronger?
No, just the opposite.
Okay.
Yeah, there's been a couple of studies. One study compared infection of people with previous infection versus previous vaccination. That was CDC. The vaccination was more effective. And then there was also a study that CDC did in Kentucky that looked at people who had previous infection in 2020. Some of them got the vaccine afterwards, and some of them did not. And the ones who got the vaccine were 2.32 times less likely to get reinfected than the folks who did not. So the recommendation is, even if you've had previous infection, you should get the vaccine as well. So the evidence from the best studies I've done so far is that the vaccine is more effective in producing immunity than infection is. I'll make that clear. Okay, more hands up.
Dr. Melnick, you said that we don't have vaccine rates for kids between the ages of 5 and 17. Is that accurate?
Between the ages of 5 and 11 for Clark County yet. I do not have that data yet.
Okay. That's my question is, are there any plans to maybe partner with schools to provide clinics at schools to help get that vaccine rate up?
That's a great question. Right now, the vaccines are fairly available in the community, so we don't have, the schools are pretty strapped as it is in terms of resources, and the vaccines are fairly available. One of the things we have done, because we want to make sure that even small practices, like small pediatric practices, have vaccine, is we've created a vaccine depot, so providers don't have to order a full tray, which they're not capable of using that much vaccine. They can get smaller quantities from a vaccine depot, and we can arrange, for transport. So right now, the strategy is to make it available in as many practices and as pharmacies as possible. I think the schools already have, given what they're dealing with in terms of, cases, tests to stay and all that other work they're doing, that we haven't really established that, setting up vaccine sites at schools at this point.
Thank you.
Yep. So I have two questions. So there's been talks that at-home tests are going to be free. Are there any plans to have at-home tests available for distribution at, community health centers? Because I do think that getting hands-on a test is difficult at this point right now.
Yeah, I don't know of any plans right now. I think home tests are valuable. I'm not sure they're, we're not using them in terms of test to stay protocols and all that, but we don't have, I don't have any, testing is an issue in the community, but as far as I know, we don't have any plans for us to be involved in the home, in obtaining home tests. But it's a good question.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe as we hear more news about kind of the at-home test, because I think that's a very good public health strategy, contain.
Yes, I think it's a good strategy for folks to, get themselves tested. I certainly think more testing should be available. I think it does have its limits, though, in terms of, for example, if somebody's in quarantine, and they're doing tests to stay in school, we do want a test to be verified, be able to verify the specimen collection as well as the test itself. But I agree with you, they have value.
And second question, what are the percentage of current tests that are being sequenced for Omicron?
So I may have this, it's going to be different in every state. I believe that the state does all along has been doing representative sampling of all specimens, and that's around 5%. I believe, and I may not need to double check that for you. And then we do sampling for variants in other unusual situations. So for example, if you have somebody who's an unusual case, maybe a young person with severe disease, or you have an outbreak that has a large attack rate, a lot of people get sick, more than you might expect, those will be sent specifically for sequencing, because we wanna basically identify new variants. You know, if it's an unusual presentation or outbreak, we might wanna suspect that there might be a variant there. So we send those for testing as well. And then the other thing that that we may be doing with Omicron is that there's something called there's S gene dropout when you do the test. I don't want to get into the details of it, but it's a sign that that may be related to the Omicron variant, because you'll get when you do the testing, that specific part of the test will drop out. We're sending those will be sent for sequencing as well.
Might be helpful for the community to know once this variant, if it does get into the community, it'd be nice to have that information on hand.
Yeah, well, like I said, Washington is, I can't speak for all of the states, but we have a pretty effective sequencing process here. And Washington was one of the earlier states where those three cases were identified. They didn't have any, as far as I know, those cases were not related to each other. It was Thurston, Pierce, and I believe King County. But yeah, we're looking for it.
Cool. Thanks.
Any other town stuff out there? Questions? Now's your chance. I have one that might make somebody else think of one. So I've heard a couple different places. One was from the pharmacist that gave me my booster, and I think I also read in what I thought was a reliable source, that the amount of secret sauce that's in Moderna is like 3 times the amount that's in Pfizer. And I understand they're not the same thing. But anyway, and that the efficacy of the Moderna seems to be better than Pfizer. And why I'm bringing this up is because I know some people who are getting close to the time when they can get boosters, young people, who are choosing to get the Moderna when they had the Pfizer, thinking that it might better enhance their immunity. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, great question. I would point out, the Moderna did have a higher dosage. It's the same. It's an mRNA vaccine, higher dosage. The Moderna booster is half the dose of the original, you know, 2 shots. So there may be some evidence that, you know, maybe you've got slightly better protection with Moderna. You know, some evidence than if you're fully vaccinated with Pfizer, but you get a really strong response to that third dose of Pfizer. So my recommendation would be, especially given that appointments are limited, that if you've had Moderna and only the Pfizer is available, I'd go for it. If you've had Pfizer and only Pfizer is available for the booster, I'd go for it. If you've had either one of them and Moderna is available for the booster, go for that as well. But you know, with that booster, whether or not you got, you know, Pfizer or Moderna, you get a pretty strong response. So I'm a recipient of 3 doses of Pfizer, and I feel fine about it. So
good.
Great. Tyler's got another question, or is that an old hand?
No, it's a new one. So it's another timing related question. So somebody waits 12 months before they get a booster. Does that mean that they've been less protected than somebody that got a booster at 6 months?
That's a great question. So I don't know that we have enough studies on that, but in terms of vaccinology in general, you don't want to be too close in your interval. It's much better to be further out, and you get a much stronger response because the body still has some memory there. You don't want to do it too soon. You'd rather err on the side of too long. That being said, you do want to get the booster as soon as you're eligible, because you want to reduce your chances of you know, getting infected. You know, if you wait 12 months, you're, you know, there's a chance, you know, that your protection wanes, you know, between 6 months and 12 months, you could have an infection. So you want to get it sooner, but you don't want to get it sooner than 6 months. Too short of an interval with vaccines is, you want to err on the side of being too long in the interview rather than too short. So like, for example, in the measles vaccine, you want to be at least 28 days after the previous dose before you get it. You don't want to get it too soon. I hope that's helpful. Too long is better than too short, but you know, you want to get it when you're eligible because you want the boost protection. Peggy, do you have another question?
Yeah.
You guys are going to dump me, so yeah.
Do you anticipate that eventually at some point in time we'll need another booster? Or do you think we'll just get into the pattern like we do at the flu shot where you receive it once a year?
You know, this, I'm going to say this all depends. It's my favorite answer. It depends on a lot of things. You know, I don't know the answer to that in terms of the current, you know, variants. I do want to say, though, that this is a global issue. And the more virus that's out there circulating, every time a virus replicates, it makes a genetic copy of itself. And that's an opportunity for mutations and the development of variants. So this most, you know, the alpha variant came from the UK, where they had, you know, high rates. The Delta variant, you know, arose in India. The you know, we need to get the entire global population vaccinated as quickly as possible, including people in the U.S., because the more that's circulating here, the more there's an opportunity for a variant to emerge. And, you know, variants, you know, the concern about variants is not only about transmissibility or how lethal they are, but the concern is about how effective the vaccines are in terms of them. So the reason I'm saying it depends, you know, you're asking about the need for boosters, but if we get a new variant that is a less response to the vaccine, we may either need a modification of the vaccine or additional boosters. So, you know, and we're still learning about this over time. So we're going to be studying this continuously, but I, you know, right now I can't predict, you know, how many boosters we may need, but the fastest way out of this is to get as many people vaccinated as possible and get the number, the virus numbers down. That's the ticket out of the pandemic, you know, to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. Then we might not need a booster. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but we'll need it less if we get more people vaccinated now.
Including little people, right? Including kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's why, I'm looking forward to when the vaccine becomes available for, you know, for children under 5. But, you know, we're seeing, in terms of transmission, we've been seeing higher rates in kids over, you know, last several months. They're a group that's unvaccinated, you know, or have heretofore been unvaccinated. So, yeah, we need to get children vaccinated as well. And by the way, you know, now that you brought up children, you know, and I presented this to the Board of Health, children are not immune to complications from the infection. And, you know, 65,000 children and adolescents, I think, were hospitalized in the past year, and it's more than that now. And a third of them ended up in the ICU, those that were hospitalized. And I don't think this is a relevant question. I get asked, you know, well, what, you know, how many of them had underlying conditions? You know, if a child dies or is hospitalized, it doesn't matter to me whether they have underlying conditions. It's a hospitalization or death. You know, one third of those hospitalizations were in children who were otherwise healthy and did not have anything. Any other underlying condition. So children are not immune to the complications from COVID-19, and with the jury is still out. We're still looking in terms of what some of the long-term effects might be. So, you know, we want to get kids vaccinated, not just to prevent spread, but to protect them as well. Any other questions or, and we'll check into, you know, if home tests are limited, we will check into that. So I appreciate that question as well.
I have one more about children, and that is that it seems like it's taking a really long time to get vaccinations to our youngest, you know, population. And those, a lot of those kids are in daycare, preschool, et cetera, whatever. It seems like it's somewhat helpful that now their older siblings can be vaccinated, but why is it taking so long to get to that younger age group?
Because they need to complete the clinical trials. So generally the clinical trials started with older populations first, and then, but it's taking a while to get to those clinical, you know, get the numbers from those clinical trials done. You know, I want to make sure that, I mean, I think these vaccines are incredibly safe, regardless of what you hear on social media. Mm-hmm. If we've talked about bears and that whole thing. But, you know, the bottom line is you want to have, you want to have enough numbers and enough data on younger children before you, before they're released. Hopefully it'll happen this winter.
Yeah, I hope so soon. And another quick question I have about the flu. So are we having another, kind of absent flu season because people are doing the right thing to prevent themselves from getting COVID?
So thank you for asking about the flu. So I'm sorry I did not bring that up, but if you haven't gotten your flu shot yet, I would strongly urge that you get the flu shot. You can get it at the same time you get at either the initial dose or the second dose or the booster dose of the COVID vaccine. You can get them at the same time, get the flu shot. So far, we haven't seen, you know, last year, we did not have a flu season, really. And that concern is that if we do have a flu season now, given that we didn't have any last year, we have a somewhat more susceptible population because we didn't have infection last year. So if we do have a flu season, you know, concern that, you know, that enters the equation. So far, we haven't seen a significant amount of flu, but there was just a, I can't remember which college campus there was, but there was an article in the CDC and the MMWR about an outbreak of influenza, H3N2, in a college population. So, you know, we're not, you know, in Clark County, and in the state of Washington, those numbers are not, you know, we're not nearly in flu season yet. But it takes two weeks to build up the immunity, and I strongly recommend that you get the flu shot if you haven't gotten it yet. And yeah, the belief is that the masking and the physical distancing that we've been using for COVID-19 is also, you know, effective against flu, which is, you know, spread through the respiratory route. So yes, you know, those activities or those precautions, masking and physical distancing, do help prevent flu, most likely, but I'm not sure people have the stamina to keep on doing it, you know, year after year. I think people are already getting pandemic fatigue, unfortunately. So, you know, we need to hang in there with masking and physical distancing for now, but it's hard to keep that going.
Would you say the vaccine, though, for flu is more effective than diligent masking and distancing?
The vaccine is probably the most effective thing we have for flu. It's between 40% to 60% effective. You know, the numbers for flu are not as high as the, you know, the efficacy for COVID-19 is higher. But you know, the best thing in terms of flu is to get vaccinated. But masks and physical distancing are very effective, so.
Other questions? Go ahead.
No, at least for COVID-19 and probably for flu as well.
Other questions? Well, we have the opportunity. I'm not seeing any hands. I think we're getting there, Dr. Melnick.
and I'm happy to answer what I can. Some of it is speculation, but in terms of what's going to happen. But we do need to get vaccination rates up in our community, so including those of adults.
That's the big message for sure.
And you really think the schools are too strapped right now to try and do some kind of collaborative effort to do clinics at school? I just know that it's so much easier for parents if there's a clinic right there in the school.
I think, that's a conversation. We meet with the superintendents weekly, and that has not come up. I haven't heard any interest from the schools to be doing that. Certainly, when they did vaccination clinics, when they did a vaccination clinic here and there a few months ago, there were protests. You might recall that happening, and that was pretty stressful. And they did, they're using up a lot of resources now. I can't speak for them. It's a great question, and when I talk to the superintendents, I will ask, but I think it's the resources we have. Like, we don't have the resources here in our health department to be going out and doing, those kinds of mass vaccination clinics as well, and I don't know that the schools have the resources, and, our interest is in getting it out to as many locations in the community as we possibly can. But, it's a good question, and we'll, we can talk to the schools about that. But, our strategy has been to, set up the vaccine depot and get as much vaccine out to providers across the county as we possibly can.
Thank you.
The other thing I recall is when we were doing those mass clinics or those side clinics several months ago, the numbers and the demand did drop off. It might increase now, but, that was our experience as well.
Right. Well, I think if there are no more questions, we'll move on. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Melnick. That was a lot of information, and thanks for answering our questions. That's always really helpful. The next thing that we're going to talk about is the updated bylaws. And we have discussed this quite a bit at our last meeting. We got some good questions and feedback from some of the members of our council, and the bylaws committee got back together and studied it some more and looked at language and got a lot of help from, in particular, Andrea and Shona, and it was a really good piece of work that we were able to do. And I think that once we were able to get it to where we felt like it was really representative of the values that we want to portray, we were able to distribute it back to all of the FAC members, and to my knowledge, there haven't been any additional questions or concerns. So what we would like to do tonight is go ahead and get a vote on this, on accepting the updated bylaws. There is a bit of a time constraint, so I'd like to call for a vote, and what we would do, and I could use a little help from Doreen or Roxanne if she's here, or Alan, as far as making sure that we do this correctly so that it's a valid vote of our members. So I believe that I can request a motion for the approval of the updated bylaws, and a second, and then I'll call for a vote.
I so move that we vote for the changes in the proposed bylaws.
I second it.
Thank you. Okay. Well, then I will call for a vote. All in favor of accepting the updated bylaws as they exist today, please say aye.
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 And if there are any no votes, please state your name so that we can keep a count. Are there any no votes? Hearing none, then the bylaws will be accepted in their current form, and we'll make sure that they get updated on the public health website. And please feel free to share that information with people in your network so they know that, that things are changing and for the better. So thank you, everyone, for that.
Yeah, thank you for all your work on that. I really appreciate all the work that was put into that.
Well, we appreciate your input, too, and you've had a unique opportunity to be involved at the, you know, somewhat at the legislative level as well as with our group, so that's been a wonderful bridge, and we appreciate that resourcefulness that you brought, so it was good work. Okay, and then the last thing on the agenda is the nominations committee. So we had a group that came together, and I'm trying to remember who all was there. It was myself and nominations committee. Help me out, Doreen. I'm just mixing it with the other committee now.
Dr. Houston, Remy was there,
yes.
And then Shauna Carter as well.
Yeah, Shauna, thank you. So we called for interested parties to throw their hat into the ring, and we did get some. And so I'm pleased to be able to announce that our slate of candidates for this coming year will be for the chair position, Aru Hedrick, for the vice chair, Sandy Brown, and for the position at large, Michelle Stickley, who's not here tonight. So what will happen next is we won't vote on this tonight, but we will bring the slate of candidates again to the February meeting. They will be presented once again, and we'll call for a vote. So any questions about that process? All right, then.
Marla, we have one other item
to add.
Okay. Apologize. So you, and this is in the bylaws, it's related to the bylaws. As are indicated in the bylaws and in the statute, you know, House Bill 1152 that passed, the FAC must have a member from the Board of Health, an ex officio member.
Yes.
So they're not a voting member. They're like me as a health officer, an ex officio member. So the Clark County Council, which is also the Clark County Board of Health, mm-hmm. voted to approve Counselor Karen Bowerman as the ex officio member of FAC from the Clark County Board of Health. So we're going to be doing an orientation for her, and then I believe she should be, you know, work on getting her at the next meeting in February.
That's okay. Well, I'm glad that decision was made, and it's my recollection that she has already attended at least one FAC meeting when she was new in her counselor role. Is that right?
That is correct. She's been really interested in FAC, and yes, I believe she attended one already.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, that's a good sign that she... It is, you know, not doing it against her will, but she actually really wants to be part of this group, and that makes me very happy. Really happy to see some stronger ties between the Board of Health and the FAC.
Yeah, that was the idea of the statute, so.
Good. Excellent. Okay. Well, so, anyone to have any... comments they want to make for the good of the order, or any questions, suggestions? This will be our last meeting for this year. Anyone have anything they want to say?
No, this is Maria. I just wanted to make sure that Doreen saw that I was here because I was running a little late.
Oh, thank you, Maria. We're glad that you're able to make it. Good. Okay, well then I think it's time to perhaps give a little gift of time during this holiday season to everyone in attendance. I greatly appreciate each and every one of you coming to these meetings and bringing your full, you know, engaged self to the conversation. And it's just a real treat and a privilege to get to work with all of you. So thank you very much, and have a great rest of the month of December and a bright and happy new year.
And Marla, thank you for your work as chair. You've done a really great job.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Totally. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye now.
Hey, everybody.
Bye.